Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says they might be better off, I think, the way it seems to me, making up their own shows, which might be better than TV. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And our other regular host, Lauren Vogelbaum, is not with us today because she is off. What's she doing? I think she is walking on the surface of Jupiter's moon Europa today.
Yeah, she is unavailable, but she did submit some information that we will be covering in today's episode. It's really too bad that she's all the way out in Europa because there's no Wi-Fi there. And if she had Wi-Fi, she could live cast into this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'd still have her here.
She could, like, Periscope from up there, except I guess there would probably be a very long delay.
A significant delay, yes.
So maybe more than 20 minutes. I don't know how long it'd be. It'd be pretty long. And so you wouldn't get your comments answered. It would be a pretty crappy live stream, let's be frank.
She would be constantly interrupting us with things that are 20 minutes out of alignment with the rest of the show. So we're going to talk today about live casting or live streaming, because it's one of those things that has become increasingly more popular, I'd say really over the last year in particular, as it's taken over mobile platforms.
Yeah, and you might be able to debate why exactly it has become so popular. Like, is this an organic popularity that comes out of people's desire to see live things happening over the internet, or is it a sort of a top-down popularity because it's being promoted by the platforms on which it happens?
And it may very well be a combination of the two. You'll just have to listen to hear what we think. But I guess we need to define what this is. And really, it's all in the name. It's broadcasting, right? Live casting or live streaming. Either way, it's about using some service or app or whatever in order to stream live video and audio from a device up to the internet and then down to an audience's mm-hmm. group of devices, whatever they may be.
Yeah, and there are actually a lot of tools out there to do this today. Now, we actually have talked about this on the podcast before, but this is one area where I feel like there has been significant growth since the last time we talked about it.
Yeah, the episode we did was back in May of 2013, my so-called life casting.
Who came up with that title? Always a good question.
It's an excellent – well, since it's 3 years ago, I'm not entirely sure. it's possible it was me, but I don't know. I definitely was aware of my so-called life and watched all of it. And why did she go with him? I mean, she didn't have to – or never mind. I'm just going to –
It's the perennial question. People have been asking since Little Women.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. Before MTV.
Okay, but anyway, so we talked about some things. We talked about Google Glass, and apparently we talked about the word vlog, too much tittering and amusement.
Yeah. We talked a lot about stuff that is quaint today. Just a mere 3 years later.
I think the idea back then was we were talking about the question of recording our whole lives.
Well, and we also talked a little bit about broadcasting because we talked a little bit about things like Justin TV and that sort of stuff. The platforms that were out there that allow people to kind of turn their lives into a reality television show or the equivalent thereof. But back then, which is weird to say for something that was only 3 years ago, primarily you did that through a desktop or laptop computer that had a webcam and a microphone, right? You didn't really have an easy way to do that in a mobile application for a couple of different reasons. I mean, you had to have the right camera quality, microphone quality.
Yeah.
You had to have the right
upload bitrate.
Yeah, that was a big one, was waiting for the cellular and Wi-Fi businesses to get to a point where you would have the throughput to upload live video, a stream of live video, and also to be able to consume that live video. But we've gotten to that point now, and I would say that the mobile approach has really pushed this live experience thing much more into the public thought than it had been 3 years ago.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I would also say that if you go with certain models of live casting, because we can talk about the different ways the live casters have approached this. Mm-hmm. If you go with the model that was envisioned by, say, the founder of Periscope, the mobile aspect is especially important.
Yes. Yeah, and in fact, there are certain ones like Periscope where if you aren't on a mobile platform, you have a severe disadvantage on the service. Like, you can watch a Periscope live stream on a desktop computer, but when it comes to things like commenting and that sort of stuff, you need to be on the mobile app in order to have that kind of experience.
Yeah. Now, we probably don't need to explain this to you, but just to briefly map the ground on which we stand, it is not a recent thing being able to broadcast video live. This is something that goes way back to, you know, live news programs.
Well, really,
it
goes back to the birth of television.
Yeah.
Because when TV first started, it was cheaper to just broadcast than it was to try and store things on a medium.
Mm-hmm.
And so it made way more sense that television was just this kind of ephemeral thing that if you weren't there to witness it, you missed it.
Here's a very slow and awkward puppet show.
Yeah.
Seriously.
There's a great sequence of skits on, and I talk about this show all the time, but that Mitchell and Webb look, which British sketch show, where they do this whole thing where it's the birth of television and everyone is incredibly awkward. And they say, it's so early now, we aren't even certain if we should be facing you or in profile. So for the rest of this, I will be facing to my left. And he just turns and and then they talk about, I know that you can hear us, but we don't yet know if we can hear you. So if you could shout, I hear you when I say this, that would be very helpful. And he says, hello, and I hear you. So, oh, I heard that. Oh, wait, that's just the set in the next room. And so this whole idea that TV is so new that they don't even know how to use it yet. Well, in a way, we're kind of in that with the live streaming on the internet, despite the fact that we've been dealing with live broadcast of video for quite some time.
Yeah, but of course, this goes on into the age where most programs are taped ahead of time. You, mm-hmm. And even a lot of times you have these semi-live situations, right, where something is sort of live but on a maybe very brief delay.
Yeah, 7-second delay is the standard you hear bandied about. That's there in case something unexpected happens.
Right.
And someone
in case
needs
one
to,
of the newscasters gets a little wild.
Right. Or something like if it's an anchor who's out there on a live report, if something happens in the frame that they feel is not something that they want to broadcast, they'll interrupt it and come back, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a protective measure. But let's talk about how the transition over into the digital version of live casting and live streaming, how that's had a big advantage over the traditional media, the television and radio, which is, you know, that set the standard for live broadcast.
But well, one obvious advantage is going to be accessibility.
Yeah.
You and I do not have the equipment to live broadcast on television because we do not have a television station, an antenna, and all those things we would need. But it turns out that these days, if you have a smartphone, you can broadcast on the internet.
Yeah, yeah. If you have either a computer with that webcam and microphone and an internet connection or just a smartphone, you can walk around and carry with you a live broadcast studio.
But I must say, even today, wouldn't it be really cool to have a television broadcast van?
Yeah. No, I mean, I've seen one parked in front of my house a couple of times. I guess it's just an area where they like to report about. Across the street from me, there's a train yard where often they shoot a lot of
I know exactly what
films.
You're talking about. I walk past that with my dog.
Yeah, so that train yard ends up being a movie set, a movie production set, a lot. So I see these, and every time I see one, I think, I'd like to have one of those. But but not having one, but having a smartphone that's capable of broadcasting live video is pretty cool, especially since I can reach people I know. And in fact, this is another big advantage that live streaming on digital has over traditional media. Traditional media, like that sketch I had talked about earlier, it's one-way communication.
Yeah, you say, can you hear me? And they actually can say, yes, we can hear you, because they can comment on the video as you're broadcasting.
Yeah, almost every live streaming app or service out there has some sort of comment or chat component to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this interactive feature that is absent in traditional media. And that's a very engaging experience when you are, especially if you're a fan of somebody and you're watching them live, and then you get a chance to say something to that person and they might react to that. That there's a bit of a rush that comes along with that. And,
well,
and we've seen that just we're not celebrities by any stretch of the imagination, but I've had experiences where I've responded to someone mentioning something online and in real time, and they freak out, which is odd, but fun.
Yeah, well, the other thing I would say is that I think the commenting back and forth aspect, it introduces an element of unpredictability and sort of a wild card variation to what's going to happen live. So imagine somebody here at How Stuff Works is doing a live broadcast on something they talked about on their podcast that week. And then a user says, hey, did you read about this thing that's pertinent to what you're talking about? And the host says, oh, no, I didn't. And then there's actual constructive back and forth going on between a content creator and their audience.
Yeah.
And they're learning from one another. It's wonderful. And on the other hand, you've got maybe trolls who want to come in and say, hey, I don't like your face, you know, you're whatever. And they both kind of play on the same thing. I mean, obviously one is good and one is bad, but both introduce this element of unpredictability. There's something real happening right now.
Well, yeah, it's more akin to live theater than it is to your traditional television show, right? Because you've actually got an audience that can impact the course of the live event.
Are they going to laugh? Are they going to clap? Are they going to heckle?
Right. And that's a lot different than if you're just in front of a camera and, you know, there's a crew there that might snicker if you screw up, or might. They do every time, every darn time. But generally speaking, you don't have that interaction you could have with a live audience.
Hey,
which
I've got
really enriches things.
I've got another thing.
What's that?
What do you know? So if you go on TV and you want to broadcast to people, there are limits on what you're allowed to do without having to pay some hefty fines.
Yeah, unless you are on like a special cable network.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're on regular broadcast television, you have to bow to the whims of the FCC here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they set down certain rules and regulations, particularly in regards to obscenity, indecency, and profanity.
Right.
So you are not allowed to say certain words. I mean, George Carlin had the magnificent comedic routine about the seven words you're not allowed to say on television.
You can say them all on Periscope.
You can. And now there's some platforms out there that have specific user agreements that say you will not broadcast, you know, like sexual material, that kind of stuff,
right,
on their platforms.
They don't want to turn into a porn hosting program.
And if you're using that service, it means that you had to agree to their terms of use, which means if you break that, if you go and broadcast something that goes against their terms of use, you could get banned or whatever, or, you know, sanctioned in some way. And it's not the same as the feds coming in after you, but it is something that's up to a platform by platform.
Yeah, and it's also contingent upon region of broadcast, I suppose.
Yes,
right?
China recently got into the news, and by recently I mean like the last week when we're recording, the week before we're recording this. And the news was that the Chinese authorities had decided to ban a specific activity being streamed on live video, and that activity would be women eating bananas in a suggestive manner. This is totally true.
I support free speech, but that is kind of a weird thing to stream.
Yeah. I agree it's a weird thing to stream. It's also a weird thing to really hone in on and say, you can't do that. In China, there are a lot of different regulations that have been passed recently in regards to this live streaming service, because it's something that's really taking off in China.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese market, of course, is enormous. The smartphone market is huge. So there's a lot of opportunity there. But the Chinese authorities, in their efforts to curtail what they see as being offensive or unsuitable material, have gone on to ban not just that, but also things like you aren't allowed to appear on video wearing stockings and suspenders. They say,
there's
a lot of different things that tend to be identified as being sexually suggestive, at least.
What if you're wearing a Mickey Mouse costume that's got suspenders? What are you going to do now?
Well, why are you wearing the stockings? It's stockings and suspenders.
Oh, I see.
So there's your problem. Then they say, well, now you've made Mickey Mouse wear stockings, and that's where we draw the line. This is not a Mickey Mouse operation, as they would say.
Well, apart from regulations being imposed from the outside by, say, government or organizations,
sure,
there are also plenty of technical limitations on what has been possible in the past and to some extent on what is still possible with live casting via digital devices, right?
Right.
Now, one of the things we mentioned earlier is the bitrate problem.
Sure.
I would suggest this is probably much more of a problem at the content creator's end than at the consumer's end,
yeah,
right?
Generally speaking, upload speeds are a tenth of what download speeds are, right?
Yeah, and you've got the problem there. If you have one viewer with a bad download speed, it just affects the one viewer. If you have one broadcaster with a bad upload speed, it affects all viewers.
Right. So one way to get around that, obviously, is coming up with new compression strategies for video and audio, right? So if you can come up with new ways to compress that live video so that it can fit in a smaller package, data package, as you send it up, that speeds things up. And then, assuming that your audience has the proper means of decompressing that audio and video, which they would because they'd have whatever app is relevant to what you're using, everything's cool because then all the work is being done by the processors for the compression and decompression. But that's just part of it, obviously. Another big advantage was when we started seeing 4G and better technologies for transmission for cellular data. Wi-Fi obviously also has improved in its upload and download speeds. So until that happened, it was not really feasible to use devices, particularly mobile devices, to broadcast live video. You could more easily record a video and then upload it, but obviously that would take a lot of time depending on the limitations of whatever technology you were using.
And at that point, it's not live casting anymore.
Yeah. Now, these days, like, I can use, and I have, I've used a live streaming service. I specifically used Periscope to live cast when I was walking to or from the office just so I could chat with folks, because that's a long walk for me. It's like an hour-long walk. And occasionally I'll just turn
Dang,
on
dude,
Periscope.
What's your data plan?
Oh, I have unlimited data, so I don't have to worry about it. Yeah, if I didn't have unlimited, that's another technical issue, right? Data caps. Uh-huh. That really is a big issue, both for, actually, I would have a more of a problem at home using my desktop, which has a data cap attached to it because of my home internet service, as opposed to using my phone, which has no data cap attached to it.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a little odd. But data caps are another technical – that's not really a technical challenge, rather. That's one that's imposed by
– It's more kind of like the FCC.
Yeah, it's imposed by ISPs, by internet service providers. But at any rate, I use this Periscope while I'm walking. I'm using it on a cellular network. But there are sections of my walk where my cellular service starts to get a little – wishy-washy, and I'm thinking it must be at a point where there's a handshake happening. Handshake is when it's being passed from one cellular tower to another. And I have often, like, there's one specific spot on my walk where people are like, the video has gotten terrible, or I can't hear what you're saying, or you're cutting in and out. And it's always in the same spot. So
that's where you're walking over the ancient cursed graveyard.
It's the Indian burial ground. Weirdly enough, it's actually at the bottom of a hill, so it's probably, like I said, right in between two cell towers where the handoff is happening.
The spirit of a bunch of prisoners from this former prison colony.
Yeah. And there are other technical challenges, too. Like, for example, the fact that if the service you're relying on ends up going down for whatever reason, mm-hmm. then you can no longer live cast, right? So if Twitch were to crash for some reason, or if the servers that handle the traffic for Periscope or Facebook Live or anything like that were to suffer some problems, then that would prevent you from being able to live stream or live cast.
Yeah.
It may be that all the equipment's working fine on the broadcaster side and on the audience side, but it's the stuff in the middle that's screwed up. So that's a possibility, too.
Well, so let's say you've got all that stuff locked down. You say, okay, we figured out how to – we've got good hardware. We've got good upload and download rates. We can compress video so that it comes through all right and doesn't use too much data. But you can still have problems because when you have a service that's supposed to provide live video to people – the service is more than just streaming the data from one place to another, right? It's also stuff like, how do you get the viewers to the place where they're going to watch it and get them watching something that they want to watch?
Yeah, there's
stuff like discovery.
Discovery is a huge challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's and that's going to get harder. In fact, we're going to be talking later in this episode about kind of looking forward at live casting, and one of the things I would like to think about is live casting just going to become similar to YouTube, in that in the early days of YouTube, if you had a voice and you had a really distinctive way of delivering your message, you had a really good chance of being discovered.
Yeah.
Today, there's so much going up on YouTube. They say like more than 100 hours every minute goes up on YouTube. There's so much stuff going up on YouTube that getting discovered is incredibly challenging.
Yeah.
I suspect that live casting is going to turn into the same thing, and probably on a much faster ramp up than YouTube did.
Well, it's too many content providers, not enough eyeballs.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think of some of the live streams I've seen where I've commented on stuff and then I start recognizing the other people who are commenting and I realize, we're all content providers commenting on another content provider. Have we just become this insular, circular audience where all we're doing is watching what each other's doing?
Jonathan, can you even imagine the horror of those of you out there right now who just hear us bandying around words like content provider when really we should be saying artist?
Yeah, I don't. Okay, there's certain words.
Performer.
There's certain words I don't like using, but I do because it's become the standard, right?
Yeah.
Content provider being one of them. But
that is what it's called in the industry. If
talent
you make
is another
stuff that other people look at on the internet, you're a content provider.
Yeah, talent is another one. I don't like being called the talent. for multiple reasons. But at any rate, there are a lot of words in the industry that I would prefer to use synonyms for, but that's kind of the standards. Also, we should just point out that there's a lot of competition already in this space, right? There are a lot of different providers offering up services that are similar to one another. And therein lies another problem, because that divides the audience further. You know, not everyone is going to have every live streaming app. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not something that most people are interested in.
Yeah.
So your audience, you have to sit there and start making decisions like, do I want most of my audience? Do I think most of the people that I need to reach are on this platform or this other platform? And you start having to make really tough decisions on that, particularly if you want to try and make a living off of this. Not everyone does. If you're just doing it for fun, maybe it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to make a living, you might say, well, what percentage of my fan base is active on Facebook versus Twitter, just as an example? Or would it be better for me to go to something like Twitch, which is a more specific live streaming video service?
You know, I used to think Twitch was just for video games until I heard that some people use Twitch to say, like, here, watch me show you how to weave a basket.
Well, for a while, Twitch was just about video games. And if your content did not have anything to do about video games, they'd say, knock that off or play some games. It wasn't until 2015 that they started opening it up to stuff that was, because I have a friend who used Twitch to live stream his podcast, and his podcast occasionally would talk about video games, but it wasn't a video game oriented podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And there were issues that he had with Twitch. It was a very popular show, but Twitch was like, no, it has to be about video games. And then about a year later, that's when they changed their policy. But at any rate, you also don't know how many of these conflicting services are still going to be around in years to come, right?
Yeah, good point.
If one of them ends up being really dominant in the space, the others might end up fading away.
Well, I think at the moment we're recording this, there is a large scuffle going on, right?
There are multiple scuffles going on. One of the scuffles is pretty much
Well, I just mean there's major there has been recently, and there is still major competition for live video views.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you've got the major players in there. Facebook is in there. YouTube is in there. Then you've got things like Periscope that are still in there. And then you have former streaming services like Meerkat, which we'll talk
Meerkat.
About. Yeah. It's
never once used it, but it has a cute name.
Has a cute name and apparently was a very easy user interface. By the time I didn't have access to it because it opened up originally to iPhone users,
mm-hmm.
and I use an Android device. In fact, Periscope was the same way. It was active first on iOS and took a while to get over to Android. Irritates me because Android is a far more popular platform, but that's a different story. It's a different podcast. At any rate, I never got a chance to use Meerkat, and then by the time I really would have taken a look at it, it was no longer supported. It's still a thing, but we'll get into that. In fact, let's talk about some of these main players, the big names that are in the live streaming field.
Okay, well, you mentioned Twitch, and should we count video game play? Because obviously, that is a form of live streaming some type of content. But when I was first thinking about the topic for this episode, I was thinking about people sort of talking to a camera.
Well,
but I guess it wouldn't have to be that, would it?
It doesn't have to be that. And also, you've got a lot of Twitch gamers who have picture within picture presentation. So
right.
The major picture is the video game they're playing, and then they have a smaller picture, which is a camera that's on them, a reaction camera.
Mm-hmm.
And they do tend to address the audience live while they play. Not everyone does this, obviously. Some people just play through a game and they're just showing how they play, and maybe that's all you're doing is just passively watching someone else play a game. But a lot of them turn it into something more, where they might be commenting on something completely unrelated to the game they're playing. They might be telling a story or explaining their personal political philosophy. It may be anything. So I think it certainly counts. The interesting thing to me is that Twitch.tv started off as a spinoff of Justin TV. And it became so popular.
Was that a Justin Bieber-based service?
No, it was not.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Named after the founder, or one of the founders. So Justin TV was pretty popular as a live streaming service, as far as those go in the early days. I mean, it was one of those things that wasn't nearly as popular as the stuff we're talking about today. But it was like Justin TV and Ustream were like the two big names in live casting. But
dude, I forgot about Ustream.
Oh, I didn't. That's where we used to live stream How Stuff Works Live.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could have upwards of 36 people watching our show at a time. but it was kept online, so you could actually watch the old episodes afterward. At any rate, it got so popular that Justin TV actually rebranded itself as Twitch Interactive, and eventually ended up getting the attention of some pretty big players in the space. It was rumored that Google was going to buy Twitch Interactive, but it turned out that in 2014, Amazon announced it would acquire Twitch for about $970 million, so just under a billion.
That's some amount of dollars.
As quite a few dollars, quite a few more than I will ever see in my entire life, which is fine, mostly. But anyway, Twitch has more than a million broadcasters and more than 100 million monthly visitors to the site. So it's a pretty big business. And, you know, I'm sure it's the sort of thing that confounds people in the cable industry. Like, why are these kids just logging in to watch some other kids play video games? We want them on our watching our shows and watching our commercials and bugging mom and dad to buy our stuff.
Right.
But it's just been wildly popular. They're professional live casters on Twitch, and the way they make their money is through a multitude of ways. They can get sponsorships, they can get ad revenue, they can have partnerships with Twitch itself. If they are a partner with Twitch, they can then charge subscribers a certain amount of money in order to access new features. For example, it may be that if you're on a Twitch performer's stream and you're in the chat room, you can chat and stuff, but you start seeing like weird emojis and things popping up that you don't have access to. If you become a paid subscriber, you get access to like VIP chat areas and special emoticons, that kind of stuff.
What happens behind the closed doors of Twitch?
Yeah, it's that exclusivity that ends up being the big selling factor there. And also it may be that the person playing is paying more attention to the subscriber chat than the general chat, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They also can ask for donations as well. It's not just through these kind of approaches. But it was interesting. It looked to me like I read an article about this, and in the article, the person who was writing it just made some estimated guesses about how much this one Twitch user was making a year, and we're talking about someone who has 900,000 subscribers and a lot of different ads and things. And they estimated that based upon those numbers and not taking into account things like donations or other sponsorships, that they were making $216,000 a year playing video games. Now, to be fair, they're also working like 60-hour weeks doing this stuff. So it sounds like, oh, wow, first that sounds amazing. And then you sit there and think, man, that sounds exhausting, too. So it's not necessarily the cushy job that a lot of people just imagine it is.
Yeah, but then again, I guess a lot of people work 60 hours a week doing stuff that is...
Yeah, maybe not as...
not as cushy as playing video games and all that.
Yeah, but you have to be good at it, too, right? Like, I guess there's some entertainment value in someone who's perpetually terrible at video games if their presentation is right.
Yeah.
But that sounds like a kind of gimmick that might not last very long for more than just a handful of performers out there. But let's talk about some of the other ones. Let's talk about Periscope.
Well, Periscope is one that we're familiar with because a lot of us here at the How Stuff Works office have done Periscope broadcasts, where a lot of times, for example, podcast hosts will set up a weekly Periscope session where they will just talk to their listeners. And so I've done that for my the other podcasts that I'm on here, Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My co-hosts, Robert Lamb and Christian Zager, and I will sometimes get on Periscope and just talk to people about episodes that have come out recently, what's coming up next, and answer questions. A lot of times people have questions about stuff that we didn't cover in each of the episodes, and so it can be a lot of fun. I enjoy it. And so the presentation of Periscope is pretty straightforward. It's just you have a camera. Mm-hmm. The camera broadcasts what it sees in real time, live. Mm-hmm. So usually it'll just be us sitting around talking to the camera. But you can also use it to broadcast, I don't know, whatever's going on around you. If you wanted to point it out the window at somebody who is scaling the side of the building you're working in with suction cup hands, I don't know why I went to that. I guess that's just something I expect to see someday. you could Periscope that. So it's that, but then also people can comment. Comments come in. You can interact with them if you want to. I would recommend if you are a Periscope broadcaster, you probably should interact with the comments because people kind of like to have that interactive experience. They want to hear back from you.
Right. Otherwise, they start suspecting that, hey, this isn't live.
Yeah.
Which is weird for Periscope, but I get that all the time on Facebook Live.
They get mad if you don't interact. Yeah. And that's pretty much what it is. So Periscope was founded by Kayvon Bakepour and Joe Bernstein. And according to the official creation legend, Bakepour was traveling in Istanbul in 2013 when a bunch of protests broke out in Taksim Square in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't at the location of the protests, but he wanted to know what was going on. And so he could check Twitter to see what people were saying about the event, but he couldn't see the event for himself. And talking to Business Insider, he said, quote, "It just occurred to me there were so many smartphones out there. Why wasn't there a way for me to ask who else was out there and what was happening there?" And so in the early press, Periscope was often compared to teleportation.
Yeah.
I find that kind of a funny metaphor because really the obvious point of comparison to me is just like having a live video camera there.
Yeah.
I don't really see the teleportation aspect, but
I think it would depend on, I think it's the fact that live video, it's tough to get live video of brand new breaking events, unless it was something that was scheduled, right? Like it's, you know, the idea of being someplace when you know something's going to happen, as opposed to the fact that since we all have smartphones these days, and I know that I'm making a crazy generalization to say all, but since there's so many smartphones out there that are capable of broadcasting,
mm-hmm.
now it would be unusual for a public event to occur where there are no smartphones capable of broadcasting that stuff.
Right.
So it is more like teleportation because unlike you're seeing, you know, a live video of the aftermath of an event, you can actually see live video of lots of events because the cameras are already everywhere.
Well, and I think that's another way that the interaction is very important. Mm-hmm. It's a very important element of Periscope where it's more like teleportation in that you can't just watch what's happening. You can comment on it and you can try to get the person who's holding the phone to do something. You say like, hey, can you hold it up higher? I want to see what's going
right.
on here.
And look around the corner, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And so that went on for a while. Twitter bought Periscope in January 2015 for what was the number you saw on that? I saw around 100 million, but there were a lot of guesses all over the place.
Yeah, it really, first of all, they keep it pretty quiet. But
right.
Secondly, because Periscope still wasn't really a thing when Twitter bought them, like it hadn't really
right.
made a big splash. It was what happened in the aftermath of Twitter buying Periscope made more news than the fact Twitter bought Periscope.
Right. Yeah. And so in August 2015, Periscope claimed it had 10 million users. More on that number in a bit.
Yeah. And also the other thing I thought was really fun about Periscope, and I'm glad that they fixed it so it no longer becomes like a means of one-upsmanship between various Periscopers, is that if you like what you're watching, you can tap your screen and it sends little hearts that mm-hmm. show up in the video.
Oh, it's so nice seeing all those little hearts float in.
It is very sweet. It's very reaffirming. And for a while, Periscope took count of all those hearts, which ended up becoming like almost like bragging rights for various Periscopers out there. Like it was this idea that by having this most liked video, it's going to jump up the charts and be easily discovered, right?
I know, Jonathan. Tell the truth. It just steamed your biscuits that you didn't get the most hearts.
It's not so much that, but rather that the system was easily gamed.
Yeah.
Like, it was very easy to just watch your own thing and just keep hitting hearts, 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 hearts,
well,
which
and
would
you
count
can,
afterwards.
You could just tell your viewers, like, hey, hammer on those hearts for us.
Yeah.
We've done it before. It's funny.
Yeah. And then so
they'll do it. They're like little automata. They just obey the commands.
Right. Well, and on the flip side, so are we, because they ask us to do things, and occasionally we do them to prove that it's live, and then it all just turns out that we're the ones being puppeteered.
Exactly.
But at any rate, that no longer holds that much water. Like, it's not something that really boosts a video's performance in any meaningful way. It's just a nice feedback mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it has any meaningful impact at this point. The other service we wanted to talk about that was very similar to Periscope would be Meerkat. Meerkat and Periscope, when they first came out, they were very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Meerkat was released in February 2015, just ahead of South by Southwest 2015.
And it was very much a favorite at that conference, wasn't it?
Yeah. And this is something we see all the time, where we'll see apps get launched either just before or at South by Southwest in an attempt to generate a lot of buzz, because that's where you've got a ton of people. South by Southwest Interactive has a lot of folks who are influential in the tech space. And if you can get a lot of people using your app, generally speaking, it tends to turn out pretty well for you. And it got a lot of widespread attention at South by Southwest, but it also relied on Twitter to allow livecasters a chance to reach an audience. It tapped into Twitter's social graph, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And then Twitter, in March 2015, cut off Meerkat's ability to use the Twitter login.
Wait a minute. Was that people. After Twitter bought Periscope?
Yeah, by a couple of months. Yeah.
Hmm.
So when Periscope came out using Twitter's API, Meerkat mysteriously no longer had access to it. And that ended up causing a lot of conversation in the space about how Twitter was allowed to do this because they're a private company and they bought this other tool. And they said, look, our policy says that if you try and replicate something that we have, we can kick you off. And we bought this company back in January, and you launched your service in February. And so it was kind of a little ugly, but Meerkat soldiered on for about a year. In August of 2015, it was already clear that the service was on the downward slope. And by March 2016, CEO Ben Rubin made the decision to change the company's focus to an always live social network. I don't know what that really means yet.
I don't either.
Yeah, because as far as I know, Meerkat hasn't actually launched anything new. But they did say they were essentially pulling all their resources off of live video. Not that the tool is gone, but there's no more development in that space for Meerkat. They said, no, that's a lost cause for us. And so it doesn't look great for live video from Meerkat anymore.
Well, yeah, and I found an article on Recode that had part of an email from the Meerkat CEO, Ben Rubin, to investors from February 2016. I thought this was interesting. So he was kind of trying to explain what had gone on with the bad year. And in what he said was, quote, mobile broadcast video hasn't quite exploded as quickly as we'd hoped. The distribution advantages of Twitter, Periscope, and Facebook Live drew more early users to them away from us, and we were not able to grow as quickly alongside as we had planned. So that's talking about one thing there is just like, who has access to people using the internet right now?
Right.
Who can steer them, you know, sort of funnel them in the live broadcast direction that that they want?
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I thought that was interesting that he said that broadcast video hasn't quite exploded as quickly as we'd hoped, because, I mean, if you read everything else, it's like, oh, man, this is the wave of the future. Everybody's got to get on live broadcast.
Well, again,
I mean, is that just him spinning it the way that makes his company look better, or?
I think it's more, again, back to that problem of so many different competitors in the space that it fractures the audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
The market share gets divvied up. So some people may be like, listen, I don't use Facebook. I just use Twitter, so I want you to be on Periscope. I've got some people who have said that to me.
Mm-hmm.
When I do, I'll put out a blast on Twitter saying, hey, I'm going live on Facebook Live at 3:00. So you can tune in at How Stuff Works' Facebook page and watch me. And I often will get messages saying, hey, I don't use Facebook anymore. Have you ever thought about going back to Periscope? And just a little peek behind the curtain, the reason why I tend to use Facebook Live more than Periscope is that, at least based upon the metrics, more people watch. So,
though those metrics are also kind of interesting.
Yeah, we'll talk about that
in a bit.
And it may very well be that there's a particular thing Facebook does that is misleading me into thinking that. But at any rate, Meerkat now looks like it's heading more toward using or developing a tool that's kind of similar to like Skype or Google Hangouts, something that's meant for a video messaging service that would be more like a closed group as opposed to one person broadcasting to a lot of people.
Huh.
So it could be like if we wanted to do a little video chat among the writers one day, that might be a tool we would use. I don't really know why they would go into that space, seeing as how it's already represented by some pretty hefty companies like Skype and Google. But That's at least some of the speculation around this. We got other examples. There's Snapchat, although that's really almost live. It's not really a live video streaming service. You can record very short video snippets, and people can then watch them. The big attraction to Snapchat is that it only lives on the servers for 24 hours.
Supposedly.
Yeah. At least it's only accessible by viewers for 24 hours. But there,
I have vague memories of us having talked about this on the show before,
yeah,
and there being some big asterisk to that.
Yeah.
Though I don't recall with enough detail to say now.
There's some definite questionable things going on. Not questionable in the sense of the content may still very well live on a server. You can actually save stuff to your snaps, too. You can save your own snaps.
Yeah.
Also, there are a lot of tools out there for people to save stuff that they see on Snapchat, like little add-ons that weren't intended originally by the service but have obviously popped up. So that's only kind of semi-live. But then we get to the big one we were talking about before, Facebook Live.
Right.
This one was a relative latecomer, launched in August of 2015.
Yeah.
And it was a controlled launch. Like, it wasn't rolled out to Facebook users at large. It was rolled out to specific movers and shakers in the entertainment industry, for example, who already had really large followings in order to kind of boost this idea early in the stage of launch, right? So some big pages that had lots of followers, or entertainers, personalities that had a lot of followers, they were the ones who got access to this tool first, and eventually expanded to all Apple mobile users in January of 2016, and then everybody else by February. So it was a controlled rollout, which makes sense. You can actually see how it's performing and start making tweaks before you give everyone access to it. And
if you haven't noticed, Facebook wants you to be watching Facebook Live. You really should be watching it.
Yeah, there have been a lot of high-profile live events that have used Facebook Live, which are all in partnership with Facebook. It's not just that they coincidentally decided to use Facebook Live.
Yeah.
These are very obviously partnerships, and there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, especially if it's transparent. But it's also interesting that apparently the notifications on Facebook Live events have recently changed. It used to be that if every time we would go live on How Stuff Works, everyone who followed How Stuff Works would get a little notification on that, and people would go and respond to it. They'd like, what's this? And they'd see a video. And some of them would get irritated because they'd get this notification. You could turn those off. I think now I did a How Stuff Works live podcast or broadcast last week. And Sherry, who is the person who kind of oversees that at our office, came in and said, yeah, we're seeing fewer numbers or lower numbers now, but we think that might be because Facebook might be tweaking the notification system so that it's not blasting everybody the way it had been.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps they were getting some negative feedback on that. So it's still in flux. Now, according to their chief product officer, Chris Cox, Facebook has more than 100 people working on Facebook Live. And part of what they're working on are some updates that will soon be rolling out and may very well, some of them may be in place by the time you listen to this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
They were announced back on April 16th, and we're recording in early May. So one of those features is the ability to filter your live streams to only certain people on your friends list. So that way you could broadcast straight to the people that you want to talk to, and it doesn't go out to everybody else.
Right.
That could be useful if you're doing something like doing just a quick update to folks, or you need to pass on some important news to your friends, that kind of stuff. Or just, you know, you just want to show off to the jerks in accounting. I don't know. There's a lot of different possible opportunities there, I guess.
Or if you're just doing your own unboxing video.
Yeah.
A nice cereal unboxing video.
Right.
Like, that's my idea. I've been thinking we should do is cereal unboxing.
Like, we're gonna do some statistical analysis with my Lucky Charms.
Oh, it's full of tricks. Wow.
What's the percentage that a green clover will come out next? They're also including some other filters that were present on Snapchat as well. The ability to apply visual filters to live video and scribble on the screen while you're broadcasting, which is not again, that different from what we've seen with Snapchat, where they have all these different filters and overlays.
Oh, you can do that on Periscope now. You can draw on the screen.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Snapchat one has some problematic filters, ones that I think they really need to rethink before implementing again. For example, they have the face swapping stuff, which is fine, where you can swap your face with some other face,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll actually animate the face with your facial motions, which is kind of creepy and interesting. But they've also done one, like they had one that was a Bob Marley filter, which put Bob Marley's face onto the Snapchat user's face, and some people said, this is getting uncomfortably close to blackface.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there's some things that people have said, like, maybe someone needs to rethink that. That actually made a big fuss on Twitter, as a matter of fact, when that went live. That was on April 20th, by the way, when that 420,
oh.
when that happened. So, they're also going to give the broadcaster emoji reactions that could pop up on screen. And a dedicated app tab just for video and a world map that will let you find broadcasts happening around the globe. So you can actually search for live broadcasts more easily that way.
Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, why did Facebook want to get into this live broadcasting game when you've already got these players out there like Twitch and Periscope and, you know, all these other ones we've already talked about? Why is it that Facebook says now we've got to be the ones?
Well, Facebook's a publicly traded company, mm-hmm. right?
And they want to own the world.
They want to own the world. You could only grow so much when 1 in 7 people on the planet has a Facebook account, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things they have to do is find new ways to engage users to make sure that they stay loyal to Facebook. They don't go anywhere. They don't give up on the platform.
Look at Facebook all day.
And by creating this Facebook Live platform, they give more reason for people to go to Facebook. They give more reason for people to create stuff on Facebook, where it lives on Facebook. It's not a link that you've dumped into Facebook.
Yeah.
It lives there.
Yeah.
And
you've seen other versions of this with things like Facebook articles, where now instead of sharing an article to link out to an external site to read something about the news, you can just click through to a Facebook news page that has an article embedded.
Same thing with Facebook video.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of embedding a link to like a YouTube video, you can upload directly into Facebook and have it live there. Clearly, that benefits Facebook, right? I mean, and it's the same sort of thing. It benefits the company, and it creates more
Facebook in your Facebook, so you can Facebook all the time.
Right. And you know, you could be cynical and just say, like, this is just a way to leverage the users and make more money. And to some extent, that is absolutely true, but it also creates more features that users can actually use and enjoy and get some benefit out of. So it's not like it's just corporate evil.
Well, no, I mean, they're trying to make money. I guess it depends on do you want to say that in a harsh tone of voice or not?
Yeah. I don't have a problem with companies trying to make money. That's the purpose for companies to exist.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, is that if they do so without any checks or balances, because companies also by nature are amoral. Despite the fact that in the United States we can talk about corporations as if they are people, they do not have any moral or ethical core to themselves. It's all about the people who steer the company, right?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Wayne Enterprises, you know.
Yeah, Stark Industries. At any rate, those are the big players. There are a lot of other ones that are in the space, too. There are tons of apps and online services, like Google Hangouts being another one that we mentioned earlier. You can do a Google Hangout and broadcast to the public, and it houses that broadcast on YouTube where you can watch live, and it will stay there. You can be able to watch it afterward, too.
Yeah. So we've got this trend now, and we've got all these people competing to be the biggest players in the live casting business. That, you know, some people out there working in the tech industry have it in their heads that the next big thing is everybody watching other people do stuff live on the internet.
Yeah.
Is that true? So one of the things we can look at is how popular is this right now?
Mm-hmm.
So there are some numbers I was looking at for Periscope. Periscope, of course, is is Periscope. It's not the entire profile of what people are doing in terms of live video on the internet, but sure. It's one of the big names. So as I said earlier, in August 2015, Periscope claimed it had 10 million users, which, oh yeah, that's not bad. But what that meant was that 10 million people had registered accounts. Mm-hmm. It was about 2 million people who used the app every day at that time. Mm-hmm. Also, at the same time, users were watching a combined 41 years worth of video every single day. According to an article I found on Recode from March 28th, 2016, that number has gone up. Now Periscope users are supposedly watching 110 years worth of video every single day. Isn't it great, these metrics we have?
Yeah. Yeah, because you sit there and like, how is that possible? I'm like, well, matters of scale, right?
Right.
You know, you just look at the number of people and then you say, well, how much time is the average person viewing? Multiply that by the number of people who mm-hmm. are on average using Periscope on a day. That's where you get that number.
Right.
It's interesting. There are other metrics we can talk about. Like we mentioned the Twitch one, right? The more than a million Twitch broadcasters and there are 100 million monthly visitors, and that was, I think, back in 2015, too. So those numbers have changed, obviously, since then.
Right.
What about Facebook?
Yeah, well, they don't really share their numbers, as far as I could tell. I dug around and could not find anything. So I imagine they're keeping that protected.
Maybe we'll hear more when they do, like, a shareholders meeting. They might have some statistics that they'll share, but at the moment we're
right.
largely in the dark.
But we do know they reportedly have something like 1.5 billion users around
yeah.
the world.
Yeah.
And from our experience, every time somebody goes live, Facebook tries to show that video to every one of those viewers.
Yeah, that seems
I mean,
to be
not
the
really,
case.
Yeah, but,
I think they, like I said, I think they've scaled back on that in the relatively recent past, but there was definitely. It still happens every time we do a live video.
Yeah, there's aggressive in-app promotion. They're trying to get people watching this stuff.
Right, and you will get comments like, what is this?
Uh-huh. And, who are you? Why am I seeing this?
Yeah, and we're like, we're just trying to broadcast
sorry,
to our
yeah,
followers.
Please,
we're
not, go about your business.
Yeah, you don't have to watch this. Please don't be mad at me. I didn't make the algorithm.
So they obviously have a strong desire to put users' eyes on live streaming video. And I can speak from personal experience and say that when you broadcast live on Facebook, I feel like the number of views you reportedly get do not seem exactly to match up with the number of viewers actively engaging through comments and liking and stuff. Now, you'd expect all the people engaging through comments and liking to be some small subset
right.
of the total number of viewers. So I'm not thinking that every viewer would be interacting, but it seems like it's actually a very small subset compared to the number they're saying watched your live video. And so I'm wondering how they quantify what counts as a viewer of a live video for a Facebook video.
Well, I can tell you that. In fact, I'll tell you that right now because I have this later on in our notes, but it's pertinent to this conversation. It takes 3 seconds of viewing the video before Facebook counts it as a viewer.
Yeah.
So if you have a video playing for 3 seconds or longer, then you are a viewer of that video. Here's the other part of that. You may have noticed that when you pull up Facebook, videos will start to autoplay. Not necessarily with sound, but they'll mm-hmm. start automatically playing. And if it autoplays if you're on that screen for 3 seconds, congratulations, you've just become a Facebook viewer. So the viewer numbers can be high because it could just be that people were scrolling through their Facebook. They came across the video. It started to autoplay. And before they scrolled off of that screen, 3 seconds had passed. And then you have this rather inflated number of viewers for your content. And it looks great. You start feeling really proud about yourself.
Well, right. They end up coming up with these numbers that make some media providers on the internet just kind of salivate over this. Oh, how'd they get that many million views on
right.
their live broadcast?
Like the big one being the BuzzFeed broadcast of the watermelon and the rubber bands. Are you familiar with this?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. I didn't watch it, but I know I saw people talking about how many views it got.
Yeah, it was like a 47-minute long video or something like
but
that.
But I also saw a breakdown afterwards that said, you know, this does not mean all these people watched the whole video.
Yeah.
Most of them watched a few seconds of it.
Right. It may have been that at its peak, I think there was like more than 800,000, I think, at its peak. More than 800,000 people were watching it. simultaneously. But then when you factor in these different components, the idea that it's pre-rolling as soon as you go by and that kind of stuff, it could give a very false positive of how many people were engaged watching your material.
Yeah.
So it's problematic with, and this is not just, we don't mean to just signal out Facebook. This is something that is a largely unanswered question in live video on the internet in general.
Well, I mean, it brings to mind the main question for me, which is personal live video streaming here to stay as like a new major thing on what data is going to be flying back and forth on the web going into the future? Or is the current popularity more of an inorganic industry fad that the platforms are trying to push this? And people are sort of consuming it somewhat, but it's not going to stay at this level forever.
Well,
it's not going to get much bigger.
I think there are certain audiences that love the live video, and they will continue to love the live video. Whether that audience is broad enough for it to support the massive amount of investment we have seen from major companies and startups alike, that's another question. It's one that I'm a little skeptical about. I think there have been some people who have said that it may very well be that this ends up being a very popular but transitory kind of fad. Like,
yeah.
It's something where after it has lived out its initial burst onto the scene, and we may be getting close to it. I mean, mm-hmm. We're a year in with the mobile stuff, that it'll kind of fade into something more like, yeah, it's like Twitter. Everyone knows about Twitter. A lot of people use Twitter, but it's not something people are necessarily buzzing about anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly think that now that we're mostly past the hardware problems, you know, now that you can broadcast without real bandwidth issues and stuff like that, there are always going to be some people doing this. But the question for me is just how popular is it going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Do people really want to keep watching the standard kind of video where somebody's just say, hey, here's my day. I'm talking into my phone for all my peeps out there who enjoy watching me talk into my phone. There's a lot of that going on. And I can also still see the continuing appeal for what the founder of Periscope was actually talking about, meaning sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, citizen journalism, people who are in a place where something interesting is going on, and thus it's more situational that they're broadcasting rather than that they are a standard content provider through
right.
these services.
So it's more of an event-based thing and not a personality-based thing in that case.
Yeah.
I mean, the personality-based stuff clearly has a place as well, simply because of that interactive factor,
mm-hmm.
right? If you are giving an audience the chance to interact with someone they admire for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
Someone they find entertaining or informative or whatever, then that's a very powerful experience. Much more so, that I would argue, than watching a static video. I mean, static video is probably the wrong term, but a pre-recorded video where, you know, yes, you can watch a horror movie and say, don't go in there, but you know that they can't hear you. But if you're doing a live video, like, I think a live video walk through a haunted house where someone's yelling, don't go in there. And like, you know what? That's a great idea. I'm going to turn around and go the other way.
But, you know,
they'd
ruin it. Yeah. Imagine if you could interact with the horror movie, you'd ruin it. You'd say, don't go in there. They'd say, okay. And then they'd leave, and then it would be boring.
No. You always have to have a backup zombie in the yard. You know, you gotta have your backup monster so that, no matter what, you're going to encounter a dangerous situation. But no, that interactivity does, I think, add a lot of value to this experience. And if the various providers out there continue to find interesting ways to boost interactivity, I think we could see this sticking around for a good long while. It may be that we have another period, like I said, kind of like YouTube, where we see a huge rush of broadcasters out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it may shake out where there are a handful, you know, maybe 100 really well-known broadcasters, and then there's everyone else, and discovery becomes incredibly challenging. I think that's going to be the, like we said at the top of the show, I think that's going to be the biggest hurdle for live casting. But I think live casting is definitely here to stay, and especially as we get even more sophisticated streaming opportunities, it's going to be built into everything, just like cameras were built into lots of stuff, just like, you know, voice activation has been built into a lot of stuff. We're going to see more and more of these being incorporated directly into products. Like the fact when the PlayStation 4 came out and there's a button on the controller for you to start broadcasting on Twitch, that's a huge message that live casting is definitely a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I expect that we're going to see more of this, at least in the near future. It'll be really interesting if it continues to be largely unregulated.
Right.
You know, that's the other question is, will there come a point where the government of the United States decides to step in and pass some regulations?
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah. I mean, it's already happening in other parts of the world. So the question is, will it happen in the U.S. and you know, in Europe and that kind of thing? And there are a lot of different things to consider. Like when I do my walk where I'm periscoping as I walk around, I try very hard to not show off too much of the neighborhoods I'm in out of the concern for the privacy of the people who live there.
Oh, yeah.
But that's me trying to be thoughtful. There's nothing to guard against that. If I were to, if I wanted to, I could just walk up to a house, periscope live there and say,
periscope in their windows.
Right. The jerk who lives here, their dog poops on my yard. So here's their address, everybody. I mean, I could do that and that would be really crappy of me.
Order so many pizzas for them.
Yeah. That would be, that's the nice way of harassing that person. But yeah.
In the innocent days before swatting.
Yes. So I'm hopeful that largely the communities will be self-regulating and self-policing, because otherwise you're going to have government agencies come into this and start to make rules, and that's going to make the whole thing harder to access. And that would be a shame. But at the same time, I definitely would be concerned about the privacy and safety of people who had not consented to be in a live video, and they're not in a public space. If they're in a public space, that's one thing. But if they're in their own yard, that's something else entirely. At any rate, this is an interesting conversation, and obviously it's still developing. We're really going to have to pay attention and see if we end up going down a pathway where everyone is having this awesome communication and we have more access than ever to all these amazing events, some awesome and some awful around the world. Or if it'll turn into like a Black Mirror situation and we'll all be regretting the fact that we ever developed the transistor in the first place. I'm curious about it. And I want to know what you guys think too. Like what are your views on this whole live casting thing? Are you a fan? Do you create stuff? Do you watch stuff? Do you watch our stuff? If you don't, you should. And let us know. Send us a message. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or you can drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. At Twitter, we are fwthinking. And on Facebook, you can just search fwthinking in that little search bar. We'll pop right up, and you can leave us a message. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.